From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Here's the scenario at one Los Angeles elementary school in one of the city's poorest neighborhoods. Students in teacher Miguel Aguilar's fifth grade class consistently make gains on standardized tests, while next door, fifth graders who pass through teacher John Smith's class each year fall behind. Same kids, same challenges. The message is that who teaches your children matters. The Los Angeles Times has embarked on a project to measure the impact of effective teaching, and in doing so, the paper is colliding with some of the most controversial issues in education today. How should teachers be measured, and should those measurements be public? Well, joining us to explain the project is Los Angeles Times investigative reporter Jason Felch. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Robert.
And one of the most controversial issues here is that you plan to publish the names of more than 6,000 teachers, along with scores showing whether they've been effective or ineffective. First of all, how did you get all this information and all the names?
In California, under the Public Records Act, we were able to obtain this information from the school district itself. So the district's attorneys decided that this was actually public record information.
You still could have published it without actually using the names. Why did you decide to make the names public?
Well, the big takeaway from our series, and after spending a lot of time analyzing this data, is that individual teachers really matter. The difference between teachers can be enormous, and which teacher a child gets is often left up to chance. So it would be difficult to have the information about which teachers are effective and which teachers are less effective and not make that public. We weighed this question very carefully. In the data that we're about to release, there are thousands of highly effective teachers who have been ignored by the school district and by their principals for years. Schools around the country do nothing to study these highly effective teachers, do nothing to reward them or recognize them. There are lots of lessons to be learned from this information, and ignoring it does not seem to be the answer.
Well, would you expect, based on this information, that parents will start calling schools and saying, I want my kid to have Mr. Aguilar next year, not Mr. Smith?
Yeah, I think that's very likely to happen, and I think it's a reasonable thing to happen, too. I think some parents are going to learn that the teacher that their child is assigned to, by this somewhat narrow measure, is not very effective at instructing in math and English, or at least that those results aren't coming through on standardized tests. What we're making clear to parents and all other readers on our database and in our stories is this is not the sole measure of a teacher, and a lot of parents care about things beyond standardized tests, and this can't tell them about that. This can only tell them how good a teacher is at raising or lowering a student's performance on standardized tests.
The numbers that you're using are called value added. I want you to explain what that means.
Value added is a somewhat complex statistical approach, but in essence what it's doing is trying to isolate the impact that a single teacher has on his or her students. The way it does that is with standardized test scores. It basically looks at a single student's prior performance and says, this student amongst his peers at this grade level was in the, let's say, 60th percentile. Well, we would expect that that would be the same under, let's say, Miss Judy. If the student goes up under Miss Judy relative to his peers to the 80th percentile, well, that appears that Miss Judy was doing something right. If the student goes down to the 40th percentile, it suggests that something in Miss Judy's instruction was not working. This wouldn't be important information with just a single student's change, but when you look at Miss Judy's classes year after year after year, then that difference that each child, what he gains or loses each year with Miss Judy, that becomes statistically significant and, in fact, very important.
Last fall, the National Research Council reported that school districts should not prematurely promote the use of value-added approaches to reward or punish teachers. I'm quoting from their release. It said, too little is known about the accuracy of these methods to base high-stakes decisions on them right now.
That's true, and I think there's a very active debate right now about what's the best use for this data. Some school districts use this to reward effective teachers with merit pay. Some school districts use this to target struggling teachers with professional development. Some school districts, like Washington, D.C., use this as 50% of a teacher's evaluation and can use it in a decision to remove an ineffective teacher. We are not making policy advice on how this information should be used, and it's by no means the complete measure of a teacher, but it fills a huge void. For years, we have known nothing about this, and so this is a window, and it may be a narrow window, but it's an important window into how our teachers are doing.
Well, thank you for talking about this.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Los Angeles Times investigative reporter Jason Felch talking about the series that he is co-authoring called Grading the Teachers. The database of teachers is expected to go public online sometime in the next few weeks, but before that, teachers in the database are invited to comment on their scores.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Federal filings show that News Corp gave $1 million to the Republican Governors Association earlier this summer. It would be a notable gift from any company, but as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, Rupert Murdoch's media empire is hardly just any corporation.
News Corp owns the Fox News Channel, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, and more than 24 local television stations, many with news programs. Murdoch is known for his business savvy and his largely conservative political views. Asked by a liberal activist this year at the National Press Club whether talk show hosts from his channel should support such political movements as the Tea Party, Murdoch replied,
"No, I don't think we should be supporting the Tea Party or any other party. But I'd like to investigate what you're saying before I condemn anyone."
Now, News Corp's million-dollar gift represents one of the largest single donations to any political party this election season. Political gifts from corporations tend to be fairly balanced, to coin a phrase. Those gifts follow power, so the guys in control tend to get more, but the money generally gets spread around, so no one is totally shut out. For instance, this spring, GE, the owner of NBC and MSNBC, gave $105,000 to both the Republican and the Democratic governors' groups. But News Corp gave not a dollar to the Democratic governors' group, according to the most recent records. Some observers say the company's actions are clearly in line with the ideological stance of its owner and its news outlets. Sheila Krumholtz is executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonprofit research group.
It's a pretty bold move on the one hand. On the other hand, I think this is not all that surprising given the very overt attitude and moves made by Rupert Murdoch and News Corp over many years.
There is certainly no secret, not only that Fox News leans to the right, but if one has watched Fox News in the last couple of years, there is evidence that it keeps leaning further and further to the right.
That's Eric Burns, the former chief media critic for Fox News. Fox has stockpiled conservative talent in recent years, adding the conservative Glenn Beck, dropping the liberal Alan Colmes, and hiring three plausible Republican presidential candidates and two top aides to former President Bush as paid commentators. Burns says that Fox News shows once brought some balance to TV news by pursuing stories that were wrongly overlooked. Now, Burns says, it's harder to tell the difference between the channel's news and opinion programs.
I don't think the million-dollar contribution will make Fox News Channel more right-wing oriented because, for the most part, I don't see how it could be.
Officials at Fox News itself declined to comment, while News Corp spokesman Jack Horner wouldn't talk on tape. But he rejected the notion that the gift in any way undercut the professional standing of its journalists. Horner said the company believed in the importance of free markets and appreciated the Republican group's pro-business agenda. News Corp's sprawling media empire generates regulatory questions at both the federal and local level. Yet this latest revelation revived complaints raised by the Obama administration last fall. Here's what then White House Communications Director Anita Dunn told NPR.
We see Fox right now as the source and the outlet for Republican Party talking points. And it's fine if that's, you know, how they want to build their business model. But we don't think we need to treat them as though they are a news organization the way other news organizations here are treated.
Officials and editors at the Wall Street Journal, the jewel in Murdoch's crown, also would not comment for this story, though one political reporter said White House officials were already pointing to the News Corp gift in conversations with the paper's reporters. The Journal covered the issue, though so far, it's been awfully hard to find on Fox. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
General Motors has begun the process of removing the U.S. government from its car business. Yesterday, GM filed papers with the Securities and Exchange Commission for an initial public stock offering, or IPO. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports.
The filing doesn't disclose how much stock will be sold, but many analysts believe the U.S. Treasury wants to sell enough to become just a minority owner of GM and raise $10 to $15 billion. That's a big IPO, and it won't be easy in this economy, says Joseph Schuster of IPOC Schuster. He says GM will woo big global investors first to encourage smaller investors to join in.
You line up the interest from funds which are flush with cash. I mean, especially in the Middle East nowadays.
Schuster's company plans to buy some of the stock, despite the risks. How much investors buy will depend on the price. Schuster says setting that price won't be easy. If it's cheap, the stock will be snapped up in a hurry. That's good, but
if it's too cheap, you know, the company itself and the government, you know, will leave a lot of money on the table.
The stock sale could happen by November. There will be plenty of number crunching between now and then to see if taxpayers will get their $43 billion of equity back. But remember the initial public offering. There will be more GM stock sold later, and it could take years for the government to sell off completely. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
This week, we've been exploring the ways that race weaves itself into American lives, and you may have noticed something about our conversation so far.
In the story of a white senator, the life of his black slave is barely recorded.
In the story of a white explorer, we only know some details about his secret black wife.
Our next subject cast a bright light on people who'd been overlooked, the celebrated writer James Baldwin. A TV interviewer once noted some details of his background.
Now, when you were starting out as a writer, you were black, impoverished, homosexual. You must have said to yourself, gee, how disadvantaged can I get?
Well, no, I thought I hit the jackpot.
Oh, great.
Baldwin said he wanted to make use of his identity as a writer. His writing drew on his childhood in Harlem as the son of a black preacher. His writing also drew on his love of English and Shakespeare. And in the 1950s and 60s, he became a leading public thinker on race.
That's part of the dilemma of being an American Negro. That one is a little bit colored and a little bit white. And not only in physical terms, but in the head and in the heart. And there are days, this is one of them, when you wonder what your role is in this country and what your future is in it.
Some of James Baldwin's essays, speeches, and journalism are now collected in a book called The Cross of Redemption. The editor, Randall Keenan, says Baldwin's complicated identity challenged white and black people alike.
He had actually been on the list of speakers for the March on Washington in August 1963, which was actually organized by a black gay man. And mysteriously, Baldwin was taken off the list of speakers. This caused his sexuality often came up when he was dealing with very conservative religious organizations and that sort of thing. And even when he, in the 70s, was trying to help organizations like the Black Panther Party, it would be thrown up at him in very hurtful ways at times.
James Baldwin was fairly open about it. It was widely known, his sexuality, at a time when that was not widely accepted at all.
Well, there was something magical about how he did that. I mean, Baldwin's second novel, Giovanni's Room, was about a gay love affair between two white men. His publisher, Alfred A. Knopf, who had published his first novel to great acclaim, they wanted nothing to do with it. And a lot of people thought, well, are you insane? You know, this, you're a young black man, and you're just going to ruin your career with your second book. What are you doing?
Ruin his career, but why? Because he would just offend everybody.
Well, yeah, it was just not done. I mean, very few people had published, other than, you know, sort of pulp tabloid sort of things. Nobody published serious literature about, you know, homosexuals. So, I mean, right out of the box, Baldwin was going to blaze his own pattern. And he got away with it. It's hard to imagine how he did. Part of it was his charisma, his rhetoric. But he did get away with it where a lot of people would have had the door slammed in their face.
There's a fascinating piece of writing in the collection that you've pulled together, and it's of a boxing match. It's of two boxers, each of whom have huge public personas, and it's the early 1960s, and they're both African Americans.
Sonny Liston and Patterson in the early 60s. This was the fight of all time. These were two major heavyweight boxers. You know, it was one of those fights that had been put off and put off, and so the anticipation had grown so great. And Baldwin went there, and it's a remarkable profile of the fight.
Well, let's talk about one of those African-American boxers, Sonny Liston. His public image was of a criminal, which he actually had been, of a guy who was connected to the mob, which was probably true, and also just of being an awful, stupid beast. What did Baldwin find when he met this man?
Well, he found him to be this gentle teddy bear. I mean, I think that so many of the things that came with his reputation, Baldwin was familiar with that. So he saw right through that and saw to the man, who was a very complicated, very dedicated, and very spiritual on many levels person. And Baldwin saw that, I think, better than most people were equipped to see it.
There's a line here in this description. He says, Sonny Liston reminded me of, quote, big black men I have known who acquired the reputation of being tough in order to conceal the fact that they weren't hard.
Exactly. Beautiful. And that puts the point right to it. I think there is a dichotomy between the way the world views a person and the way your folk see you. So I think that what we see in this piece is, you know, underneath that veil, which a lot of people who aren't black and who haven't come up in those situations might not be aware of.
You know, here's another quote from James Baldwin. He's addressing an audience here. He says, you give me this advantage. And I think when he says you, he's talking to white people, white America. He says, you give me this advantage that whereas you never had to look at me because you've sealed me away along with sin and hell and death, my life was in your hands and I had to look at you. I know more about you than you know about me. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think the situation of African America has always been one of the minority being placed as observers of the majority culture. I mean, we'd see the television, we read the newspapers, we are privy to so much about white folks' lives, and I think not even a tenth of that is known about the minority by the majority. So I think he was very well placed in being able to say that I know much more about you than you do about me.
Where do you think that comes out in his writing?
Well, certainly in the fiction and in the nonfiction, most loudly in The Fire Next Time in 1962.
Describe that, the context of that piece and what he said.
Well, he was asked by the editor of The New Yorker to interview the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, one of the founders of the Nation of Islam, this black Muslim sect, and he went to Chicago to his mansion and interviewed him. And it turns into this essay, this long peroration, a sermon about race, and it became a huge rallying point for black folk and white folk. And it was one of those times when I said, he lifts the veil. And white people felt that they had an insight into black America that they didn't have before.
Do you think Baldwin forced white Americans to look at themselves differently?
On some level, I think that we're taking ourselves back there. The tensions were so high. There weren't a lot of places for people to communicate. So Baldwin gave people something actually to talk about. White folk and black folk could get together and say, oh, did you read this? And on top of that, I think that he did give people, when he talked about growing up poor in Harlem, when he talked about the Pentecostal churches, when he talked about what it felt like to be this young black boy who was discriminated against, I do think he gave people an insight that they otherwise wouldn't have had.
Our series is called American Lives. The book is James Baldwin, The Cross of Redemption, Uncollected Writings, which have now been collected by Randall Keenan. Mr. Keenan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
At our website, npr.org, you can read James Baldwin's essay, Why I Stopped Hating Shakespeare. This is NPR News.
A new poll shows that a growing number of Americans believe that President Obama is a Muslim, and the numbers who say correctly that he is Christian are declining. That is a shift from last year. Now more than 40% tell pollsters they don't know what the president's religion is. This comes from the Pew Research Center for the People in the Press, which talked to 3,000 people in this survey. The survey was taken before the argument you just heard Don Gagne discussing really heated up between July 21st and August 5th. Joining us to talk about the poll is the president of the Pew Research Center, Andrew Cohut. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Linda.
Thank you for being here at dawn. President Obama calls himself a Christian, Andy. We all remember the controversy over his pastor in Chicago during the campaign. But the number of people who identify him as Christian is declining from about half to about a third. Why?
Well, the percentage of people saying, I don't know what religion President Obama is, increased from about a third, 34%, to 43%. And I think this has to do with the fact that religion is not a prominent part of Barack Obama's persona. Now, I think the increase with respect to the number who think he's a Muslim has to do with something else. I think that's the intensification of negative views about him among his critics. All of the shift, all of the increased mention of him as a Muslim basically comes from people who disapprove of him.
So what can you, does that mean politics, Republican politics, conservative politics, can you identify them?
Well, it's largely Republican, it's largely conservative, and as I said, overwhelmingly people who don't like Barack Obama. It's part of, I think, of a mindset of people who are personally critical of Obama saying, well, you know, he's not like us. You know, there's this whole birther thing that goes on and on. In any event, the real critical issue from the perspective of the broad public is that this falling recognition of what his religion is. Even Democrats are less of the view that he's a Christian. That declined from 55% to 44%, and more of a view that, hey, I don't know what religion the president is, from 32% to 41% over the course of a year. And a majority of people say a president having strong religious faith is important to them. They don't want a president who governs by religion, but they see it as an important value.
Now, certainly people were in no doubt about George Bush's religious faith or Jimmy Carter's religious faith. We've had presidents who make a big point of it, and then we've had other presidents, Ronald Reagan comes immediately to mind, who did not make a big point of going to church all the time.
Yeah, and that may be in part Obama's problem here with respect to what his religion is. I mean, President Bush set such a high bar in terms of his religiosity that looking at Obama and saying, wow, he's not very religious, the point of reference was President Bush, who was very religious. So there's that.
Do you think that this public attitude plays into the current controversy over building the Islamic Center? Do you think that it leads the president's opponents to think that this might be potent political ground for them?
Well, I don't know whether it played in the minds of the public, whether it played, I don't want to speculate whether it plays into this controversy, but it certainly is grist for the mill of those who are politicking on the president and looking forward to the midterm elections.
Andrew Kohut, president of the Pew Research Center, thank you very much.
You're welcome.